Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Gramsci, the Southern Question and the Mediterranean. This talk is delivered by Professor Peter Mayo.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience on Campus FM. We welcome you to, we're coming up to the last two in this year's seminars in the series Work in Progress in the Social Science. Today we are happy to welcome Professor Peter Mayo of the Faculty of Education. And in 2 weeks' time, on Wednesday, 5th May, we welcome Professor Ivan Kalous of the Department of English, who is going to read a paper with the mysterious title Neanderthal Humanity, Representations and Speculations. So I think we still have some very interesting work to present to you tonight and in 2 weeks' time. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Peter Mayo to our series. Peter Mayo is co-convener of this series and a fellow chairman of various seminars. He is professor and head of the Department of Education Studies at this university. He has published many books and published in different languages. In 1999, he published Gramsci, Freire, and Adult Education, which has since been published in many different languages, Catalan, Portuguese, Spanish, German, Italian, and Turkish. In 2004, he published Liberating Praxis, Paulo Freire's Legacy for Radical Education and Politics. That was published by Prager, but republished by Sense in 2008, and it was the recipient of the 2005 Critics' Choice Award by the American Educational Studies Association. Again, it's been published in other languages. He then went on to publish Adult Education in Malta in 2007 with Carmel Borge. He has co-written Learning and Social Difference, and he has also written Public Intellectuals, Radical Democracy, and Social Movements, a book of interviews. In 2002, he co-edited with Carmel Borge, Gramsci and Education. And in 2009, he edited Education in Small States with Routledge. And this year, he has edited Gramsci and Educational Thought, published by Wiley Blackwell. This, of course, in addition to many articles in academic journals. He is the current president of the Mediterranean Society of Comparative Education for 2008 to 2010. So, Peter, we very much welcome you, and he will be speaking to a paper entitled Gramsci, the Southern Question and the Mediterranean.
Thanks, Paul, and don't take my bio too seriously. I'm a walking recycling plant, that's why I do those things. Okay, Gramsci, the Southern Question and the Mediterranean. Let me make this clear at first that this is a perennial theme in Gramsci's work. There's a famous essay which Gramsci was writing at the time of his arrest in 1926, and it's an interrupted manuscript, which is also accessible in English. You find it in a number of publications. The first, actually, English very small volume, slim volume. I think it's the first one. I'm not sure. 1957, I think, it's by Louis Marx, contains the Southern Question in this volume. Now, many people limit their analysis of Gramsci's work concerning La Questione Meridionale. It's Questione in Italian, but as Anna will tell us, that's archaic Italian. They used to say Questione, so he writes it as Questione. I have to be careful when I write that in Italian because people think it's a misprint. And basically, it will be, it's not a good idea just to confine yourself to that piece. First, because Gramsci then returns to the subject when he is working in prison when he worked in prison, during those 10 years in which his brain was supposed to be stopped from working. Well, it certainly didn't work for 20 years, as the prosecutor said, because he died after 10 years. He was released on compassionate grounds, but he didn't leave the hospital, and from there he was taken to the Acattolico Cemetery in Rome, not far away from where this guy in front of me, you spent a number of years. But anyway, not in the cemetery, I mean, but, you know. The convent is very, very close, which is also the place where Benigni lives, by the way, the famous Aretino. Okay, Gramsci's discussion of the southern question, I'll read, but I'll stop, and I'll explain, which runs throughout the Quaderni, because it runs throughout the Quaderni del Carcere. I mean, he didn't return to that paper, probably because he didn't have it, or also because it became part of his larger project, the project he was aiming to complete in prison for Eric forever, obviously he probably never realized that the notes he jotted down are going to be regarded as a masterpiece of 20th century political theory. I mean, those things were smuggled out of Italy, and it runs throughout, especially in his notes where he looks at the Risorgimento and what the events which led to the Risorgimento and beyond, notes on Italian history. And of course, Gramsci does not glorify the Risorgimento, far from it. He sees it as a sellout. Sellout by the south towards the north. So Gramsci's discussion of the southern question, which runs throughout his Quaderni and is therefore not confined to his interrupted essay, Some Themes Regarding the Southern Question, hi Mario, Alcuni Temi sulla Questione Meridionale, henceforth I call it the Southern Question, is that which probably more than anything else attracted me, I'll be honest here, attracted me many years ago, 20 years ago probably, to the Sardinians' work in the first place. And the reason is that I found a connection with my own being as a Maltese studying in Canada at that time. So I had to go to Canada, in Redneck, Alberta, to discover, well, to read Gramsci. I've heard about Gramsci. Some people actually were we used to mention him a lot. And these writings and notes help shed light on the geopolitical context in which I was born and raised, just like you here. It is for this reason, or I would say the majority of you, it is for this reason that I seek to extrapolate from Gramsci's writings concerning the Southern Question insights for a greater understanding of some current dynamics in politics and culture in the Mediterranean region at large, a region which I conceive of as an expression of that larger construct referred to as the South. So the structure of argument is this. The paper opens with some general considerations regarding different conceptions of the Mediterranean, linking the region with the broader South and highlighting issues of subalternity. Subaltern is a term which is associated with Gramsci. Subalternity connected with the Mediterranean and with the South, actually, in its global context. The Mediterranean is viewed in a manner that takes account of both its northern and southern shores. Efforts are made, drawing on Gramsci's own reflections and anecdotal accounts, to avoid romanticizing the Mediterranean and the South in general, and to capture some sense of the region's complexity. No prizes for guessing that the region is really complex. I mean, importance is given in this context to the issue of dominant belief systems, with reference to Gramsci's own views on religion. The issue of religion leads to questions concerning ethnicity and religious beliefs of people with different traditions coexisting in the area, especially southern Europe, the focus of Gramsci's attention. The paper foregrounds one of the major challenges for social solidarity facing people of this region. Namely, I'm not going to be stuck in the past, that is, I'm trying to see what we can extrapolate for today. Namely, the challenge posed by massive migration from south of the equator populations to the north in the context of the intensification of globalization. The Gramscian theme of regional solidarity for a revolutionary socialist politics based on knowledge and understanding, and the related themes of misplaced alliances, which is a recurring theme, especially in that interrupted manuscript that I refer to, and internal colonialism, these themes are taken up. The paper moves from Gramsci's discussion focusing on North-South solidarity, in his case proletariat and peasantry at the time, in the context of a nation-state, and it will move beyond that to a broader and transnational form of North-South solidarity rooted in political economy and an understanding of colonialism connected with issues of migration and inter-ethnic solidarity. Educational strategies for this purpose are identified. So, let's talk about the construct which is the Mediterranean. For me, these are all constructs. Europe is a construct. The Mediterranean is a construct. Like all regions of the world, I just looked for a picture which, I don't know, we might associate with the Mediterranean, although be careful, which is the Latin sail. Actually, that's from India, actually. But anyway, like all regions of the world, the Mediterranean can at best be regarded as a construct. This region is, getting old. I just, have to take off my specs. It's conceived of in different ways by different people according to their location in the north-south axis. There are those in Northern Europe and possibly other parts of the Western Hemisphere who conceive of the Mediterranean in a colonial, ethnocentric and Eurocentric manner. They historically seem to have regarded the southern part of the Mediterranean as the target for a quote-unquote civilizing mission. They also see the division between north and south of the Mediterranean in immutable and therefore essentialist terms. When I was working on this paper, my good friend Michael Gregg helped me a lot, in fact, and so did Joe, in terms of comments that were sent to me, very, 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 copious notes written, and that made me rethink some of the issues. They possibly even see this division as representing the battle line between Christianity and Islam. Pride of place is often given within this conceptualization to those traditions that lie at the heart of West, quote-unquote, Western civilization, which for me is a very problematic term, notably the Greco-Roman tradition, where explicitly or implicitly any indebtedness of this tradition to civilizations emerging from the southern Mediterranean is denied. One often finds this conception also amongst colonized subjects. For as Frantz Fanon wrote in your language, which I never learned, I'm using a translation, the colonialist bourgeoisie in its narcissistic dialogue, this is from the Wretched of the Earth, of course, expounded by the members of its universities, had in fact deeply implanted in the minds of the colonized intellectual that the essential qualities remain eternal in spite of all the blunders men may make. The essential qualities of the West, of course. The native intellectual accepted the cogency of these ideas, and deep down in his brain, you could always find a vigilant sentinel ready to defend the Greek-Latin pedestal. And unfortunately, I have come across some of my Greek professors, some of my Greek friends who are professors of a certain age in education, and they just go on with this whole idea of humanistic education, which is basically Greco-Roman paideia. And then Cornel West has a much more interesting version on this, because he's now using hip-hop to promote his kind of anti-racist approach, and he calls that dancing paideia. This process of cultural invasion, now this is me, not Fanon now, leads one to think of the Mediterranean only in terms of those centers in the region which are directly associated with the Greek-Latin tradition. In this respect, the Rome-based Croat scholar, actually Bosnian Croat scholar, Predrag Matvejevic, writes, "We need to get rid of this European habit of speaking about the Mediterranean and think only of its northern shore. The Mediterranean has another shore, that of Africa and the Maghreb." Now, the sub-theme for this section of my paper is avoiding romanticizing the South. Others construct the Mediterranean differently, projecting it as a region having all the characteristics of what can be broadly called the South. Now, I know this is very, very, very controversial. I've met people from Africa who say, "Do you consider yourself part of the South?" You know, and people have visited Malta, actually. Here is a, so, you know, right. It's really bone of contention here. Here is a vision of the Mediterranean that connects with a larger and more expansive notion of the South. Needless to say, the South has its contradictions and should therefore not be romanticized. After all, Gramsci himself, a Southerner, who reacted strongly to any attempt to caricature the South, criticizing even those who were at the time, before the Communist Party was created, socialists from his own party, that is, such as Ferri, Nocifero, Sergi and Dorano, he criticized them for their positivist and pathological affirmation of what they perceived as the Southerners' biological inferiority. However, even though he railed against this kind of caricature, he never romanticized the region from which he hailed. He regarded most of the unsavory aspects of life in the South as folklore, and did not shy away from underlining the most shocking aspects of his native Sardinia. These included the different forms of superstition from which he, Antonu Ninu Sugobbo, Gobbo that is, suffered as a disabled person. Holding his parents responsible for not seeking professional help for what would nowadays be diagnosed as Pott's disease, and for giving in to the popular myth that anyone born with a disability has a terrible birthmark, which has to be hidden from public sight. Hence his mother's fabrication that he damaged his spine when falling from a helper's arms. His most shocking depiction of the horrors of... this is something I've already mentioned here. Okay, just give you, want to go over the points. Well, if you, anybody can send me an email, I can send you the PowerPoint and the paper too. So you get two for free. That's very rare these days, but anyway. Now, where is that blooming description from Gramsci? Here it is. Okay, I'll give it to you in Italian, as he wrote this in the letters, and I'll give it to you in English. So his most shocking depiction of the horrors of Southern life is provided in that much-cited letter to Tania, sister-in-law, that is, when he was in prison. He was writing letters to various people, including his sister-in-law, who was one of the closest persons, together with Piero Sraffa. Whenever they wanted, whenever the Communist Party wanted to give him bad news, they sent Piero Sraffa. This is documented, by the way, by Giuseppe Vacca. In a much-cited letter to Tania of 30 January 1933, where he discloses that he once witnessed a disabled young man confined to a hovel, fit for animals, of course. The 10-year-old Antonio was taken there by the young man's mother, from whom he was to receive payment on his own mother's behalf. And there it is. She told me to accompany her to a certain place, and that on returning she would take the crochet work and give me the money. She led me outside the village to a small clearing cluttered with debris and rubble. In one corner there was a hovel resembling a pigsty, 4 feet high, without windows or openings of any kind, and with one heavy door as an entrance. She opened the door, and immediately one heard an animal-like moan. Inside was her son, a youth 18 years old, of very swarthy complexion, who was not able to stand and therefore remained seated, and lunged in his seat towards the door as far as the chain around his waist permitted him to go. He was covered with filth, and was red-eyed like an animal of the night. His mother emptied the contents of her bag, fodder mixed with leftovers from home, into a stone trough and refilled another container with water. Then she closed the door and we went away. I did not say anything to my mother about what I had witnessed, given the impression this had on me, and that I was convinced nobody would have believed me. So, You know, the interesting part is that Gramsci actually opens the letter by saying that he was, yes, he's got his misfortunes, but he's seen people who are much worse off than he is. Now, here is a person who is, you know, he couldn't even see his son, the one who died about 2 years ago, and in prison, with all the pains that he had, even since he was a student, etc., etc. Okay. It can be argued that Gramsci, an atheist who was the son of a deeply religious woman, with strong spiritual beliefs he respected, you can see this from the letters from prison, written to his mother and other people, even though he did not share them, of course, if he's an atheist, as manifest in his letters to his mother, Peppina Marcias, also regards the kind of Catholicism that prevailed in the southern regions and islands of Italy as another undefined aspect of life in the Mezzogiorno, the south of Italy. The Catholic religion, as Gramsci shows, is tied to strong material interests in the southern region of Italy. It is connected to land, priests were land administrators, usurers, the power structures and folklore. It traditionally served as a buffer against modernizing forces, and as the Brazilian thinker Paulo Freire would argue with respect to the traditional church, or what Cornel West would call the Constantinian church, in closed societies, such a church would mold, the people's common sense, and I'm using common sense in the way Gramsci uses it, so it's very fragmentary, which has elements of good sense, of course, in it, along immutable and fatalistic lines. The arrogance of southern ecclesiastical power was reflected in Gramsci's time, according to Gramsci, that is, in the morally lax attitude of priests, and I put morally lax in single quotation marks, in contrast to northern priests who were perceived to be morally more correct, again in quotation marks. So these priests served as subaltern intellectuals and were viewed rather cynically by the peasants themselves. Il prete è prete sull'altare, fuori è un uomo come tutti gli altri. A priest is a priest on the altar, outside he is a man like all others. Now these peasants would nonetheless aspire to see their children join the clergy, and therefore move upward within the power structure. This strong connection between religion, hegemony and power in this part of the world needs to be borne in mind in a context increasingly being characterized by the influx of immigrants from outside the peninsula, including immigrants from North Africa now, who cling to a different belief system. The role of southern intellectuals, including the dominant cosmopolitan type of southern intellectual, cosmopolitan in single quotation marks, those who speak a language which ordinary people don't understand because they've become academicized, if you like, right? And Gramsci will obviously hold, what's the name, the philosopher, Benedetto Croce, another Benedict, Benedetto Croce and Giustino Fortunato as being responsible for this process of taking away potential organic intellectuals from their environment, well, like just like himself probably, and therefore they no longer spoke a language, and you know, Gramsci was obsessed by the issue of language. That was his subject, that was the subject he studied at university, to which he made interesting contributions even as a student. I hope they're not romanticized, this thing, but you know, he sees this as the lack of a link between intellectuals from the South, which has given so many traditional intellectuals to Italy, traditionally. I mean, Croce himself is from Naples, or from the Naples area, Gentile is from Sicily, son of peasants, etc. Croce came from a wealthy family, of course. And he sees this as a big cleavage, you know, between intellectuals and the rest of the people. And this has ramifications for his concerns about language, about, you know, why is there no national popular language, etc., etc. But anyway, there are people who are much more qualified than I am to speak about this, notably Lo Piparo and Peter Ives. People have been publishing a lot about this. So, the role of southern intellectuals, including the dominant cosmopolitan type of southern intellectuals, who speak a language that cuts them off from the people, as well as subaltern intellectuals, because you've got the grand intellectuals, but then those who have a big name, etc. But then you've got teachers, priests, you know, notaries. Reminds you of a country called Malta. Notaries, lawyers, etc. Subaltern intellectuals. It's also analyzed for these intellectuals' part in sustaining the agrarian bloc, and hence the subaltern status of the southern regions vis-à-vis the north, within the contemporary, at this time that is, post-Risorgimento hegemonic setup. In short, Gramsci does not romanticize the South. He highlights its major shortcomings, which, unlike many socialists of the period, he does not attribute to some biological inferiority, established, and I'm quoting Fanon here, scientifically, the sort of perception of biological inferiority presented as scientific truth and thought in the universities for over 20 years that Franz Fanon decries in The Wretched of the Earth. On the contrary, Gramsci attributed such shortcomings to the exploitative internal colonizer-colonized dialectical relation that characterized post-Risorgimento Italy. Now I go into religion, ethnicity, and subjugated knowledge. The alternative conception of the Mediterranean as an expression of the South, conceived of is in its broader context, leads to an appreciation of the region's richness and cultural diversity, as well as the many voices and identities it comprises. One can consider many of these voices and identities marginalized, typical of southern voices and identities. In the Eurocentric centers of cultural and intellectual production, these voices and identities are constructed as forms of alterity. Alterita, and they are often rendered exotic, if not demonized, being very much subaltern voices, engendering, in Foucault's terms, a subjugated body of knowledge. And yet, as I shall attempt to show, also drawing from Gramsci's writing in the Quaderni, this body has in the past, this subaltern, exoticized body, has in the past contributed significantly to the development of what is referred to as the Western tradition. The Mediterranean gave rise to many things, the three great monotheistic religions, many of which have a hegemonic presence in several countries of the region, and therefore feature prominently in Gramsci's own analysis throughout his work, notably his prison writings. His insights concerning Catholicism, often enhanced by his reading of Civiltà Cattolica, Catholic Civilization, which was a rivista which was actually distributed in the prisons where he was, and papal encyclicals, and his insights about Islam are of great relevance to the current situation concerning religion and ethnicity in this conflict-ridden and heterogeneous region. The link between religion and ethnicity becomes most pronounced in various parts of the region, owing to one of the major features of the intensification of globalization, as it has affected this part of the world, namely migration by south populations from the south to the north. A process that, strictly speaking, globalization is a process which, strictly speaking, has always been a feature of the capitalist mode of production, characterized by periodical economic reorganization and an ongoing quest for the exploration of new markets. In fact, it is most appropriate in the present historical conjuncture to repeat the term that I have just used, the intensification on real time of globalization. This intensification is brought about through developments in the field of information technology. This process not only blurs national boundaries, but also shifts solidarities within and outside the national state. Mobility is a characteristic of globalization's inner and outer circuits. We can speak of mobility in terms of the threat of the flight of capital in a scenario where the process of production is characterized by dispersal and cybernetic control, outer circuit, and mobility of workers within and beyond the region, inner circuit. according to Braudel, okay, where you have all this movement, etc. According to Braudel, as you know, there was a time when exchange was a prominent feature of life in and around the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean basis, le longue durée, or you would call that. In this day and age, however, please excuse my horrible French, in this day and age, however, the exchange takes on a different form. In terms of mobility of people, it would be amiss to consider the exchange one that occurs on a level playing field. It can also be argued with respect to the movement of people from the southern Mediterranean to the northern Mediterranean and beyond, that the spectre of the violent colonial process the old continent initiated has come back with a vengeance to haunt it. This process is facilitated by the requirements of the economies in highly industrialized countries concerning certain types of labor, and the consideration that these requirements cannot or should not, to minimize labor costs, be satisfied by the internal labor market, despite the high levels of unemployment experienced within these countries. And I'm quoting Ursula Appich there from the University of Frankfurt. It was written a lot about Gramsci as well. Right. The legacy of colonialism and its effect on the migratory movements from the South Mediterranean to the North Mediterranean and beyond reflects a similar colonial bind, albeit of an internal nature. Italy's north in a process of colonial domination of the country's southern regions and islands that Gramsci emphasized in his writings on the southern question. His writings focus for the most part on the need for solidarity among subaltern groups across the north-south divide. The concept of national popular, so much emphasized by Gramsci, takes on a specific meaning in this context. What is national is often tied to the culture of hegemonic ethnic groups and is related to the whole structure of hegemony. Concepts such as national identity, national culture, yeah, we know this, are thus challenged as part of the process of negotiating relations of hegemony. I mean, hegemony is not something static. It's something which is in flux. It's characterized by negotiation and renegotiation, in Gramsci's sense. Yeah, this applied to relations between different groups within the boundaries of a single nation-state, the object of much of Gramsci's analysis. Subaltern groups involving peasants and proletariat had to engage in a historical bloc, a concept he derives from Sorel, as you know, to challenge the concept of national and transform the relations of hegemony which it represented. In this regard, one had to challenge misplaced alliances. These include the proposed alliance, now this is something that Gramsci had written about in his time, the proposed alliance between the exploited Sardinian peasants and their offspring on the island and the mainland, the continente, and the offspring of the exploiting Sardinian gentry, the local Sardinian overseers of capitalist exploitation. So you've got for him it's a false alliance, because they're Sardinian, with no regard to class difference, etc. So this is the significance of the episode in his piece on the Southern Question concerning the effort of the eight communists to thwart the forming of the Giovane Sardegna, a challenge which proved successful and which led to the postponement sine die of this proposed Sardinian organization. The same applies to the episode concerning the role of the Brigata Sassari, the much lauded Brigata Sassari, the Sassari Brigade, with respect to industrial unrest in the north. Here the issue of cultural and ethnic hybridization is raised by Gramsci, who regarded the process of solidarity between workers and peasants, proletariat and peasants, industrial proletariat in Turin basically, and peasants in the south as likely to be helped by the fact that the former consists for the most part of offspring of the latter, given that much of the industrialization in Italy's north was predicated on internal migration from the industrially underdeveloped and impoverished south. Gramsci highlights the bonding that emerged from conversations between the soldiers and strikers that led to the realization that both were victims of the same exploitative process. The themes of solidarity, therefore, and the struggle against misplaced alliances become two of the most important features
of his writings on the South, especially the essay on which he was working at the time of his imprisonment in Rome, A Southern Question, Alcuni Temi, sulla questione meridionale. They have great relevance for the Southern Question when viewed in a larger context, the context of North-South, South-North relations on a regional and transcontinental scale. One major difference, however, is that crossing national borders is more difficult and hazardous than crossing regional ones within the same country. As the Slovenian writer Slavoj Žižek rightly argues, in the much-celebrated free circulation opened up by global capitalism, it is things, commodities, which circulate freely, while the circulation of persons, themselves, I would put in brackets, nudged by Michael, themselves treated as commodities, is more and more controlled. And yet, this is from the book Iraq, the Borrowed Cattle, and yet often risking life and limb, being at the mercy of unscrupulous coyotes, as our friends across the Atlantic would say, thousands and thousands of migrants crossed the new Rio Grande divide between North Africa and Southern Europe, many drowning in the process. If I can play around with Gramsci's statement concerning the north of Italy in relation to the Mezzogiorno, Europe with its colonial center was an octopus which enriched itself at the expense of the South in its broader context. We're still in alliances here. All right. Now, where's my good friend Walter Rodney? Anyway. Right. Anyway. Where was I? All right. Okay, long-term victims of the predatory colonial process that led to the ransacking of Africa, these migrants, often from sub-Saharan Africa, who travel via North Africa, attempt to reach the centers of Europe, once again a case of the empire striking back, but often end up at the continent's periphery if they make it to North Africa, passing through certain parks even connected to South Africa, in fact. The intermeshing of cultures that this brings about leads to further questioning of old hegemonic arrangements and the concepts that reflect them. The concept of national popular, takes on a new meaning in this context. Meanwhile, old but still prevalent concepts such as national identity and national culture, resorted to by sections of the often self-proclaimed autochthonous population as part of a xenophobic retrenchment strategy, are called into question by those who derive their inspiration from Gramsci and others, more recently Said, who draws on Gramsci's Southern Question in his work, and who aspire to a society characterized by social justice. The greater the presence of multi-ethnic groups and the stronger the lobby, the greater will be the struggle to renegotiate relations of hegemony within the countries concerned. In this respect, there is relevance for the current situation in Gramsci's insistence that the Turin communists in the north of Italy, which I reiterate, largely included people of southern origin, his insistence that they bring the Southern Question to the attention of the workers' vanguard, identifying it as one of the key issues for the proletariat's national popular politics. Furthermore, the National Popular Alliance of Italian Workers, and here is where Gobetti comes in, because he found a great ally in the liberal Piero Gobetti, furthermore, the National Popular Alliance of Italian Workers and Peasants, advocated by Gramsci but also Piero Gobetti, well known for his La Rivoluzione Liberale, takes on a larger, more global North-South meaning in this age of mass migration from South to North. Any genuinely socialist initiative today, and this comes from the heart, must bring to the forefront the issue of the Southern Question in its larger context, extending beyond geographical boundaries and territories. And for me, this must be done in the interest of generating North-South solidarity and confronting misplaced alliances. I would include amongst these misplaced alliances the false alliance between labor and management against the competition. globalization has brought in its wake misplaced alliances based on racist labor market segmentation strategies. Workers continue to be otherized, created as other, and segregated on ethnic, national, and religious lines, as well as on such lines as those of being refugees, asylum seekers, and quote-unquote economic migrants. Such an anti-racist program of education and social action can only be successful if rooted in political economy and an understanding of colonialism. These are the elements that Gramsci sought to bring to his analysis of the Southern question in Italy, placing the emphasis on political economy and a historical understanding of Italy's Italian internal colonialism. Gramsci's use of political economy is most evident in the Southern question, that interrupted essay, and the notes concerning Italy's post-Risorgimento state, see Notebook 1 of the Quaderni, the prison notebooks, where he gives economic reasons for the subordination of the South, reasons that are also supported by the work of economic historians such as Luigi De Rosa, La Provincia Subordinata, Saggio sulla Questione Meridionale is the name of this Feltrinelli book essay. Gramsci writes about the northern economic protectionist fortress strategies ruining the southern economy. These strategies included the tariff wars with France that had a deleterious effect on southern agricultural life in Italy. Likewise, economic power blocks today, I'm trying to, you know, use some of these concepts and try to read the situation. Likewise, economic power blocks such as the EU and the United States today adopt the fortress economic and agrarian policies that impinge negatively on economic development in Africa and elsewhere. With a daily $1 billion subsidy provided by the wealthy countries to their farmers, people from poor countries that depend on agriculture will find it hard, and have been finding it hard, to feed and educate their children, with migration often at terrible costs proving to be their only option. Okay, so now I go to the final part, actually. Educating for solidarity, a lengthy process. Using material from Gramsci with respect to the Southern question and related themes, such as those concerning Arabs and Islam, one can identify some of the ingredients for the kind of work that genuinely socialist parties and other organizations can carry out to generate the consciousness necessary to foster greater solidarity amongst different subaltern groups in this situation characterized by massive immigration to the southern European countries. This is one of the greatest challenges facing those committed to a socialist politics in this region. I would say all over the world, actually. The work involved is unmistakably of an educational nature, as was most of the work in which Gramsci was engaged when attempting to generate a truly revolutionary working class consciousness in the Italy of his time. After all, education is for Gramsci fundamental to the workings of hegemony itself. So, you know, if you want to speak about education and Gramsci, you have to read everything. Just don't read, you know, the notebook 4 and 12 about the school, or the snippets he's got about workers' education. The whole project is an educational one, geared towards an intellectual and moral reform. And we made this point, Joseph Buttigieg, Carmel Borg and me, in the introduction to an edited volume we did called Gramsci and Education. Actually, that came from Joe himself, Buttigieg. So one has to give credit there. And the kind of educational work in which one must engage in the contemporary context is a lengthy one. With local working class people living in a state of precariousness, being the ones most likely to suffer from the devastating effects of neoliberal globalization policies, this work becomes ever so urgent. Unless such an educational strategy is developed, it is more likely that working class people become attracted to the kind of populist, right-wing and often neo-fascist discourse that plays on their fears and leads to further segmentation and antagonism among workers on ethnic lines. Now, I'm sounding more like the early Gramsci pre-prison here, who wrote pamphlets. This can result in misplaced alliances and the mystification of the fact that both they and the immigrants share a common fate. Maybe not to the same degree, of course, that of subalternity, and of both being victims of a ruthless process of capitalist exploitation. There have been cases when traditionally socialist parties have been accused of shunning the responsibility of working towards fostering inter-ethnic solidarity amongst workers. They are accused of doing so for fear of losing electoral votes, a situation which highlights the limits of bourgeois democracy for a genuinely socialist politics predicated on worker solidarity across ethnic and national lines. My proposal for an educational strategy for greater... For greater solidarity in this day and age includes developing a broad terrain of cultural studies. I mentioned political economy, but of course, how can you talk about Gramsci and not talk about the cultural dimension? I think the two are inextricably intertwined, which entails a deep understanding of the culture of alterity. This would include, but of course not be limited to, knowledge of the different religions of the Mediterranean, including the religions which immigrants bring with them from other areas, such as sub-Saharan Africa. That's where Michael's hand comes in again here. Once again, as with Gramsci's portrayal of the southern regions and islands in Italy, one must also avoid romanticizing these religions, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and African religions. They would be subjected to critical scrutiny. Avoiding caricatures and exoticization of the type which Gramsci decried with regard to northern conceptions of the southern alleged biological inferiority and northern misrepresentations of legitimate struggles of southerners who were denied land by the northern liberators. The references to brigantaggio, brigand activity, and the widespread exaggerations surrounding its manifestations. Challenging misrepresentations and conceptions of the other, in this case immigrants from the southern shores of the Mediterranean and beyond, which reflect a positional superiority on the part of those who provide the representation, to use Edward Said's language, culture and imperialism. Right, let's get smaller here. Okay, analyzing seriously the relationship between Islam, traditional African religions, many migrants who cross the Mediterranean come from sub-Saharan Africa, of course, and modernity. Gramsci writes about the existence before World War One, of a circle of young Christians in Turin, including Dominicans, who drew sustenance from modernizing tendencies in Islam and Buddhism, conceiving of religion as a syncretization of all the major world religions. Istra. Challenging essentialist a la Huntington, Pasha d'Anima Sua, he's dead now, notions of immigrants, Islams, Arabs, Africans, blacks, etc., all are much more variegated than Huntington and his like would have us believe, there being no fixed and static cultures, but cultures which, on the contrary, have flourished as a result of hybridization and cultural cross currents. Gramsci, for instance, writes about key Arab leaders and how they sought to confront a more universalistic Islam with a sense of national unity and adaptation. And he argues that in many places the Islam of his times was already different from what it was earlier. It will continue to evolve, but not suddenly, he argues. He felt that it cannot be substituted by Christianity, which took 9 centuries to evolve, while Islam is forced to run, I would translate as dizzily, vertiginosamente. A rather contentious assertion, in my view, that reflects an evolutionary development model, which I can be found problematic. The last point warrants some further commentary. Monolithic, essentialist conceptions of Islam are provided by right-wing Westerners as well as Muslim fundamentalists. In his critique of Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations, Edward Said wrote, Huntington is an ideologist. This is from what's the name of the newspaper where he wrote this? Anyway, it will come. Huntington is an ideologist, someone who wants to make civilizations and identities, and they are both in inverted commas, in quotation marks, into what they are not, shut down, sealed off entities that have been purged of the myriad currents and countercurrents that animate human history, and that over centuries have made it possible for that history not only to contain wars of religion and imperial conquest, but also to be one of exchange, cross-fertilization, and sharing. This far less visible history is ignored in the rush to highlight the ludicrously compressed and constricted warfare that the clash of civilizations, quote-unquote, argues is the reality. Said, Edward Said, who I've just quoted, made the point time and time again. The Nation is the outlet, the newspaper, the review. Said made the point time and time again about there being no such thing as pure cultures. What we have are hybrid cultures, a point Gramsci demonstrates forcefully in the prison notebooks and in such works as The Southern Question, where he indicates the intermeshing between southern immigrant workers and northerners in Italy, with the implication being that there is an intermeshing of cultures in these regions. Southern immigrants contributing to northern culture and vice versa. On a broader scale, this ought to lead to a consideration of non-European contributions to aspects of what is heralded as Western civilization, quote-unquote. In this respect, Gramsci echoes many others in highlighting the contributions of Arabs, Islamic culture, and other non-European cultures to the development of so-called, quote-unquote, Western civilization. In a note 5 in Notebook 16, Gramsci makes reference to the work of Ezio Levi and Angel González Palencia, the latter outlining Arab influences in cuisine, medicine, chemicals, etc. Derek Bootman has written a lot about this from the University of Bologna. Gramsci furthermore reminds us that the Arab post 1000 influence on European culture via Spain. He states that philosophical and theological disputes in France during that period betray the influence of Ibn Rushdie, Averroes, and his doctrine. He also underlines what should be commonplace knowledge, that and yet which on the evidence of my own teaching experiences, not just in Malta, I mean, this is shocking, seems to be ignored, namely the Arab and Jews' reintroduction of ancient philosophy into European civilization. Also in Notebook 5, Gramsci mentions the scientific influence of Arabs on the formation of Germanic Roman states, specifically on medieval Spain. Others have also referred to the work of Miguel Azim Palacios, a very famous scholar from Spain, in this context, notably the Italy-based Egyptian scholar Mahmoud Salem el-Sheikh. Now, where is that? Who in an article, Le Omissioni della Cultura Italiana, he often appears on television, this guy, in debates, Le Omissioni sulla Cultura Italiana, writes about the debtor's syndrome, il sindrome del debitore. And I will read this in English translation, which I translated, probably badly, but anyway. The person to whom one is indebted is constantly a hated person, particularly if the creditor, as in this case, is a strange body, rejected by the collective consciousness, hated by the political, social, cultural, and religious institutions. If anything, the rage against the creditor in these circumstances becomes an almost moral duty and a necessary condition for the survival of that society. Now you have got the Italian version there. Anna, quanti punti mi darai? 30 lode? Okay. Right. Furthermore, the Turkish writer Ali Hasbi insists, not the translation in English, the knowledge and technologies which are the shared heritage of humanity were not created ex nihilo, but were built up in a lengthy process of accumulation to which every people has made its contribution. Efforts are now being made to give the West credit for a unique and absolute rationality and a creativity
which are seen as consubstantial with it. This demonstrates amnesia and ethnocentricity. The importance of these contributions... No, when is this going to finish? Anyway, the importance of these contributions, including the direct and indirect contributions of black African cultures and other cultures, see for example Bernal, 1987, cannot be overstressed in an educational process intended not only to do justice to a culture or cultures, for instance those of Islam and Arabs, which are not to be used interchangeably, and this is to be a common error, not only to do justice to a culture or cultures that have often been denigrated in a process of historical and cultural amnesia predicated on ignorance and prejudice. This process should serve to highlight the hybrid natures of cultures crisscrossed by contrapuntal, that's taken from Said, although we used to use that a lot in literature much before, from music and literature, etc., contrapuntal currents, and set the record straight with respect to flawed conceptions of cultures that give one a sense of positional superiority and falsely lead to the construction of cultures and civilizations as being mutually exclusive and antagonistic. In this respect, one must recognize that Christian, Jewish and Muslim fundamentalists are also guilty of a similar historical and cultural amnesia when projecting a fixed notion of their religion and when being reluctant to acknowledge derivations in their religion from other civilizations and philosophical traditions that were in turn indebted to other civilizations and philosophical traditions. In conclusion, over and above an understanding of colonialism and its political economic basis, one must also understand the long-term effects of the imposition of a contrived world cultural order. This work would enable us to foster that sense of solidarity that Gramsci had called for. These are the elements that Gramsci sought to bring to his analysis of the Southern Question in Italy, with his emphasis on political economy, astute cultural analysis, and historical understanding of the Risorgimento, or passive revolution, with its implications also for language, and the process of internal colonialism it brought about. And just to sign off, I would say, an earlier version of this was published in the Mediterranean Journal of Educational Studies. This year, an Italian version of this was published in what were the Atti, the proceedings of a conference which took place in 2007 in Rome. Unfortunately, the person who put it together is passed away this year, Giorgio Baratta, which is the Italian version there. That's the one. And it's coming out in German. Now, I don't know German. I just copied this from the email where they give me the details. In this journal called Das Argument, this is a Brechtian figure here, which is the German, the journal published by the Berlin Institute for for Critical Theory. So, I hope I haven't bored you, and that is the conclusion of my presentation.
With regard to Gramsci and your presentation of the Southern Questions, my one question that I would open with would be something like this. In this process of internal colonialism and this process whereby, in fact, some cultures are rendered or regarded as inferior to others, where do the words
constructed,
stand?
Constructed.
Given the fact that Gramsci is first and foremost a political strategist, and that my understanding is that he's first and foremost concerned with praxis, that is, some sort of union of theory and praxis.
Yeah.
Where does the workers stand at all this? Because I think the evidence one might see of workers in Malta is that they are not less racist or cultural.
Yeah, I made that point, actually.
Well, yes, but what's Gramsci's point about this? How would Gramsci react? Yes, how does the seeming impervious of many working people in many parts of the world under the capitalist mode of production to specifically...
So you're asking me, how would Gramsci see this?
Yes.
And he's been dead so long ago, I can't, raise him from the grave to ask him. But anyway, well, no, just kidding. Well, I wouldn't know. I mean, you know, one can build all kinds of constructions of Gramsci himself from fragments and from all sorts of writings, and one has to keep in mind where he wrote what and at what stage. The impression I get from what he writes, the way he inveighs against fellow socialists and their construction of other people, and, you know, he's very, very, how should I put it, respectful. He's very, very, he's almost reverence towards Arab culture, for example, etc. Seems to suggest that he, being a Sardinian, but that could be me now in the 21st century, or having lived most of my life in the 20th century, analyzing Italy today in terms of north and south. I would probably imagine that when he went to Turin, he himself was probably a victim of that kind of and I think I read this somewhere by one of the Paetas who actually mentioned this, because he was obviously very knowledgeable. He used to throw his book knowledge at them. He was young. Who's this guy who came from the south with all this baggage, bagaglio, of Spencer? You know, he used to use Spencer a lot, and all this, you know, and all these people. And sort of, who is this guy to go teach us, you know? That guy actually was a brilliant student at the University of Turin, who was actually singled out by a very well-known Italian linguist, Bartoli. I mean, if you ask Joe Brincati, he'll tell you about him. As the archangel who will defeat the grammarians. Of course, nobody helped him to finish his studies, or so we believe, because of his pains, and he used to miss exams, etc. So, for somebody like that, and Gramsci was the sort of person who, in his analysis, would make these connections between things, how would he probably would have seen that as one of the struggles of the... And that's one of the points of my paper, actually. At the time, it was Southerners and Northerners, and not with much of an influx. You know, I'm sure there would be, you know, it's always a hybrid society, but not much of an influx that you would have today. And he would rail against anybody who denigrates, you know, people from the South on those bases. And then at the same time, he never romanticized the South. He himself would never romanticize the South in that particular regard. Now, of course, there are big limitations on Gramsci, and I wrote about that in a book. My first book on Gramsci was 1999, also published in German by Argument, in fact. And, of course, I mean, the person, what do you expect? I mean, he died in 1937. I mean, don't expect to have this broad vision of different identities, etc., that we are now accustomed to today. I mean, and, you know, today we still are faced with racism, sexism, etc. So, you know, somebody writing at that time, I would say he had a lot of foresight in terms of social difference. How couldn't he? He himself being a disabled person. All right, he himself who suffered because of that. He wasn't poor, eh? He didn't come from a poor family. He came from that class that he spoke about, the civil service. In Americanism and Fordism, his notes on Americanism and Fordism, please don't go away, that Gramsci wrote some kind of treatise or chapter called Americanism and Fordism. That is the misconception that comes across because of the good work that Quentin Hoare-Nowell Smith did by organizing his notes. Okay, but people would run away with a false impression that these were essays. I mean, even Stuart Hall says in his essay on education, Gramsci did not write an essay on education, he wrote a Quaderno 4, and which he revisited in Quaderno 12, notes about the Unitarian school, if anything. I mean, he never romanticized. So, in his Americanism and Fordism, I mean, he does talk about the civil service, and his father was one of those. I mean, I went to his house, I've seen the house, it's not a house of a peasant. And the people in Ghilarza, know the Gramsci family. You can go today and meet people of a certain age, and they would know the family. Because even his nieces, etc., were still living up to a few years ago. The last one was the daughter of Teresina, his sister. So they know the family, and they always said that the Gramsci family was not one of those families which would really mix with them. Now he says, or some biographers who probably want to romanticize, because, you know, we put people on a pedestal, they would say that he mixed with children of peasants. But, you know, I was told there in Ghilarza 2 years ago by people who knew the family. I mean, and they would be in contact with mobiles, so members of the family, because we had a book launch there. And offspring, etc. The Gramsci family was, and you just see the museum, which is his house. And there were no, I don't think there were, I don't know, Anna, you were there recently, Ralph. I don't think there's been alterations. That is the house. That is not the house of a peasant. Okay, I mean, so, you know, that's not a, but, the fact is that his writings betray, they show that he had a sense of social difference. I mean, he's writing about women, for instance. Obviously, very much influenced by plays that he saw and reviewed. You know, because there's this other side to Gramsci. He doesn't know, you know, people are not familiar with Gramsci. I know that people are postmasters at that, but there are people who are, you know, he was also a writer for Avanti and other newspapers, and when he was aligned to the Partito Socialista Italiano, which was a bit of a catch-all port with different currents inside. The most radical was his, the Ordine Nuovo group with Terracini and Togliatti, etc., from which then eventually the split at Leghorn, I don't know why I use the word Leghorn, Livorno, took place. But what happened it was that the way he writes about women, for example, his first public talk, according to Quentin Hoare, his first public talk in Turin as a young man was about the emancipation of women. In Americanism, in his notes on Americanism and Fordism, where he shows the difference between Italy and, for example, the United States, where Taylorization had taken off, you know, where Fordism had taken off, when he talks about we have a rentier class, which the Americans don't have, etc., etc. He talks about the new feminine personality. We also know how he waxed lyrical in his review of Ibsen's Doll's House. Now, that's something that Ibsen himself, in a different period, of course, Ibsen himself refuted. You know, that famous coup de théâtre at the end, when Norma Helmer slams the door. It's more of a George Bernard Shaw kind of interpretation of Ibsen. So, where would he stand about this? I would assume, given the emphasis on solidarity and misplaced alliances, I don't know if I've answered your question. He would probably, I don't know. I would assume that he would take up this position.
He would accuse the peasants of false consciousness or misrecognition.
He what?
He would accuse the workers, excuse me, of false consciousness.
Well, that's putting it a bit crudely. I mean, okay, well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, basically, I can only talk about the evidence which is demonstrated what he writes. And what I'm trying to do is trying to build something out of it myself. So it is not basically trying to, you know, like to recreate Gramsci, and it's as if I, you know, I'm in dialogue. Well, it can be a dialogue, you know, but it's to resuscitate to bring, in his own words, a dead corpse to life. All right?
If I understood you correctly, what you're trying to do is to try to see whether some of the themes that Gramsci was interested in, some in question, can be revived and perhaps applied to...
Still relevant today.
Yeah, still relevant today. I think it's an interesting approach, and I want to get to that, but I just wanted to make a few comments. Because perhaps nowadays when we approach Gramsci, there's a whole heritage of people who have been perhaps influenced by him, or even have not been influenced by him. You emphasize very much that education was important for him. I mean, it's a theme.
But education in a broad context.
Of course, absolutely. Not education, absolutely. I mean, that might seem to have might have seemed revolutionary then, or at least new then. But it's something which is sort of very Galenic. And when anybody looks at, I mean, nowadays theories of the nation state, and so on. I mean, it's very Galenarian. I mean, perhaps we approach, perhaps from anthropology, wouldn't approach him. I mean, you'd see it much more sort of in a gender perspective. In other words, the state required some type of mobility, education, etc., etc. Perhaps the surprise, too, that you were sort of seem to be quoting as regards intellectuals moving, like you talked about, Croce and Gentile and all these sorts of things. I mean, that wasn't just related to Italy. I mean, throughout Western Europe, including France and Britain too, there was always possibilities, even, you know, in much more, in a way, rigid socialist systems like the Ottomans too.
Mm.
It was always possible for somebody from relatively humble backgrounds, and that was how elites and how administration drew people up. I mean,
yes, we've seen it even here.
In effect, I think it is. It's not actually. A feature of agro-literate civilizations. Mm. Agro-literate civilizations, if you have education, some degree of even restricted education, they're going to inevitably draw people out.
Yes, but Gramsci used the first specific purpose. I mean, the situation is very different in terms of the state, and I think I've written about, we can't discuss the state the way it was discussed in Gramsci's time. So what I'm trying to make sense of is, how does this apply to some of the issues we're facing now, with particular reference probably to the migration issue. So I've written stuff about the state and how does one, what difference exists between the various theories of the state today. Today it's a very different state from the one that Gramsci's talking about. What does it mean, for example, but this is a different discussion altogether. I mean, what does it mean to the relationship between state and civil society as Gramsci understood it, not civil society as it is used today? What sense does it have in an era of globalization? When the state itself now is almost confirming his view, because it's now drawing up policy through governance with networks, what they call it, heterarchy, networks of other people involved in policies, ranging from other agencies, industry, etc., down to NGOs. And there's a whole debate right now between the involvement of NGOs in from the West in Africa, for example, right now. I mean, yes, but that's a different argument for me.
No, but I think that is where, I mean, what I was perhaps just sort of struggling with is the problems of the applicability of...
I never use the word applicability. If anything, I would say reinvent.
Okay.
Which is too much of a cargo cult kind of term.
No, but it's precisely perhaps because, I mean, the nation state. I mean, when Gramsci was writing, the nation state was a very solid... structure or being constructed.
And in Italy was quite new.
Exactly.
And in historical terms.
Absolutely quite new.
Whether it was accepted by the Italians is another matter.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to sort of wonder about now, or question, is that, we're operating in a very different political setup. The state is too big for certain things and too small for others. There is no, as perhaps, there was something recently, I think, by Christeva, where she says, how is nowadays very difficult for people to revolt, because they don't know where to revolt. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the time of Gramsci, I mean, there were definite positions. There were classes, at least he viewed things in that way.
Certain functions of the state are still there. The state still has a role today.
Well, no, I'm not doubting it, but I think it's a bit more...
It may have changed.
Opaque.
It's more opaque, of course. It's much more, it is opaque, it's much more, how should I say, when it comes to policy making, it's much more networking, sort of. That's how we're led to believe, as well. That's some of the most recent theories. I mean, what I try to do here is precisely to go beyond the confines of a nation state. I'm talking about North-South in a much broader context, not just... Of course, that was a particular period in history, which is different today. Not in its fundamental thing, but it's the state plays a very important part in the kind of thing that I'm talking about here. For example, more than through the use of consent, but particularly through the use of repression. And migrants are the victims of that, because it's a carceral state we have today. Ranging from the Americans, sending up, bombing places and denying funds for social programs to service the debts in Iraq, debts, debito, I'm talking about, and we saw the results of that through Katrina, down to, for example, our own state here, who intervenes through its position in Frontex to safeguard people who are victims of neoliberalism through structural adjustment programs, etc., who come and knock on our doors. Placed in cages, basically. So it is very much a carceral state we have. So the repressive function, and there is never a repressive function without an ideological function. There's no such thing as 100% ideological state apparatus, or 100%, even Althusser would say that, from the very beginning. So there are many elements. Let's not underestimate the state.
Let's say certain things appear to have changed. The way of operation has changed. But the state plays a very important part within globalization. The nation state I'm talking about. It's not withered away.
Let me latch on to what I think Paul tried to say, but then we sort of went sideways. So let's give it another go. Observers of the Gramsci industry, now feel that we're more or less at the end of roughly a 50-year interest in Gramsci. Given that the Owl of Minerva flies at dusk, perhaps it's the right time to begin to classify various approaches to Gramsci. And let me, for the sake of argument, adopt a very simplistic classification. There is a hard and a soft approach to Gramsci. The soft approach to Gramsci is the approach that tends to romanticize him and turn him into an exotic, to canonize him.
Radical hero.
Depending on, various trends then of this approach. But generally there, the focus of that sort of Gramscian study is, it's essentially exegesis and very often hagiography too. So, we go back to him and picture him in various poses of holiness or near holiness. What is interesting is that this particular line, the soft line, is also that which is most acceptable to orthodoxy. You'll find in this line people who go back to him and say, look, basically he was the Marxist who did not have illusions that you could speak about, society only in economic terms, as if Marx ever did that. The soft guy, the acceptable guy. The result is essentially a very utopian romantic Gramsci. Incidentally, this is also the line that insists on interpretations which have been shown over and over again to be absolutely false. Such as, for example, that the concept of historic bloc is a Sorrelian one. That is a fiction we keep turning and turning into various washing machines, tumble dryers and whatever. And you compare the two concepts and they really have very little to do with each other. The other line, the hard line, is that which says, look, I mean, okay, let's stop canonizing him, let's stop trying to reconstruct him in a utopian romantic mode, and without any further ado, and irrespective of the fact of whether he broke his back when falling from his nanny's arms or whatever, let's in practice use some of the concepts he outlined. One of them being the concept of historic bloc, which is probably his most important methodological contribution to sociology, understood in a broader sense. This hard line has stopped trying to exhume Gramsci, and without any further ado, uses Gramsci. Often, and rightly so, without having to stop and say, this is a Gramscian approach. Now, this latches on to what Paul is saying, because when we look at Gramscian work today, very often we leave out all that which has been inspired by his approach, especially the historic bloc approach, and neglect it totally. One example is the use of the historic bloc notion, not too far off from the social formation notion in post-Althusserian Marxism of a particular school. And, you'll find that it's alive and well today without continuously referring to its own partially Gramscian roots in Latin America. With people like Anibal Quijano, for example, who is totally on I think on Paul's ground when he says, look, you know, the notion of nation and state here needs to be rethought because it doesn't help us absolutely. And I think the Latin American example is useful to you because of the notion of regionalism, which you, incidentally, there was a lapsus somewhere there. In the section on religion, you wrote region. Yes, no, but that's good. I would have hoped you were going to look at region as such and to try and deconstruct the notion of Mediterranean. But unfortunately, then it was anecdotes on his relation to religion. So what I would like to suggest is that perhaps we should look more closely at actual politically relevant, academically very respectable work beyond our own little Euro-Mediterranean, somewhat incestuous, and Gramscian studies are becoming very incestuous. Doesn't promise well for the future. Offspring tend to be a bit weaker that way. And look at the way it's used in practice, especially there where it doesn't necessarily wave the flag, hey, I'm Gramscian. There is a lot. There is a lot, including in this country. So perhaps this conversation ought to continue.
How do you see this in this country?
No, that would be taking this a bit too far away, and it would, I think, deviate from your presentation, because there's lots of things you said which are worth discussing. What that would deserve is obviously a whole session to that.
Hmm. All right. Can I comment on the Latin American experience? Because I have an interest in that also when I studied.
But don't throw back phrases.
No, I'm not.
I didn't accept that.
Where is that? No, I'm not. But I wonder, you know, like...
Things in the direction of the romantic
view. Yes, of course. No, but... if he was here, I mean, Father, what's his name? You could have backed me up. I wonder what would you make of, for example, not the situation now, but the situation when the PT, the Partido Trabajadores, emerged. It did not emerge out of nowhere. Okay, some of the leaders were in exile, etc. But their connections with various groups in Brazilian society. Now, obviously, there seems to be a cleavage, because within the party itself, there's a big difference between the municipal PT and the federal PT. Federally, have to deal with much more harder politics, I would say. Where you had this kind of link between various groups ranging from the MST, the landless peasants, to pastoral land commission. It's very difficult to say where does one stop and where does the other begin. And the unions which had emerged before the coup d'etat and survived despite all these terrible years of military autocratic rule. This kind of coming together at a particular point in Brazilian history, do you see that as falling within the link between, for example, a party and its links with, for example, the CUT, which is the trade union, with other movimento Sem Terra, etc. Does that fit into something which relates to Gramsci's historical bloc? No, but there was a particular goal here. I mean, there was a sense of conscious direction given to that particular party, which in itself was supposedly born out of these movements themselves. I mean, Lula himself came from the trade union background, a certain side of the church was involved, you know, liberation theology, and although it's not as powerful as people think.
Okay, but don't add any more ingredients to the minestra, because it's already complex enough. I am not 100% certain I understood your question. But that's good, because I can turn it
into my own discourse. The situation in Brazil, when you had this... There were obvious links between...
I cannot speak about Brazil with any competence. But about a month and a half ago, I was on the Bolivian-Peruvian border, and I got involved it wasn't planned at all, into an interesting argument about something that was happening there in, at that particular moment. The Peruvian and Brazilian governments have just, well, about 3 months ago, underwritten an agreement by Brazilian and Peruvian companies to set up a hydroelectric plant with dam and all the changes that that requires on the Peruvian-Bolivian border, roughly around Lake Titicaca, near Puno. And the interesting thing is the reaction to this project, because it brings about this sort of problematic you've just indicated. You know, I happened to be particularly around that day because I had to meet someone from the local university there. And you had a situation where practically everybody took to the streets to protest against this hydroelectric dam and power station project. What is extremely interesting was the mix of political, local, municipal, if you wish, political forces involved in fighting this. On the one hand, you had people of the so-called Humala movement. Humala is a very strange political character with possibly a military, very right-wing background, today using very leftist language, very populist, violent. I'm quoting something you mentioned. Very populist, violent, and a guy who's extremely strong electorally in all the south of Peru, getting about 60-70% of the votes in all local elections in the south, for the time being essentially limited to the south. It's not clear what this guy wants, but whatever it is that he wants strikes a chord, and people vote. Then you had another large coalition of folkloristic movements, people who, NGOs if you wish, but real popular NGOs, who are for the revival of Quechua language, local dancing traditions, who go around with, the pre-Columbian flag, which is the rainbow flag of the pre-Incas and pre-Incas. Difficult to decipher what it is that they want. They're hungry, really. They want progress. But they think that if this comes from a central government, then it can be right for them. And they fit in well. From a central government, from Lima, it can be right for them. No, right there would be loaded. It can be good for them. And they seem to really go, to fit in well with Humala's movement and tend to vote for him. Then obviously you have a large spectrum of green groups, most of which come from Lima. These are together, with the exception of the Greens, the state in southern Peru, because they do have in their hands local government, and that in the south of Peru is an extremely hard state structure. They actually even have their own police, so that the whole thing becomes very, very, very comic, because these are out in the street, there when people demonstrate they really do, and police really shoot. At the same time, there's loads of shooting, loads of tire burning, loads of beating up. But at the end of the day, the policemen involved and policewomen involved happen to be the children of the people protesting. So eventually they get together, drink chicha together, and go home. If, by the way, there's no working class involved there, because absolutely no industry of any sort, which might come into being if this hydroelectric dam is put into place. So that's another issue there in the background. APRA, a traditional center-left now, Social Democratic Party, is strong in Lima and Arequipa and places where you have industry, but obviously absolutely absent in these areas, and they simply don't speak the same language. Now, where does Gramsci come in? Gramsci in practice comes in here because a largish political party in Peru that originally splintered from APRA is that founded partially by Mariátegui. And Mariátegui is an extremely important source of ideas, very Gramscian. It's not yet very clear exactly what contacts there were between the two, but certainly he went back with a Gramscian baggage. Without necessarily having to say, hi, I'm Gramscian. If you look, but not, be careful of saying that he had a big impact, because then we go to the very generic. I think Gramsci deserves that we read him close. I know you do. But let's not sell this generic.
No, in Latin America.
Specifically, we're talking of Mariátegui. Specifically with Mariátegui, what is transmitted is the notion of historic bloc.
Mm.
And Mariátegui says, look, if we keep looking castigating the Limensian and Arequipanian working class because they're racist, Paul A, they're racist too. I mean, for them, the Cholos, the mountain natives are as bad in their eyes as the Sicilian peasant was when in the 60s went to Milan and grew carrots in his bathtub, and Milanese workers would say che terrun, and so someone like Mariátegui says, let's not say, look, the working class are a bunch of assholes because they're racist. He says, let's begin from the fact that they are. And if we're to do anything, we need to somehow find a hard connection between them and the Cholos, and therefore a historic bloc. But to understand what sort of historic bloc we need to change things, we have to understand what sort of historic blocs there are now. Therefore, I think Gramsci would really not, I think, like being sventolato, someone who very abstractly calls for solidarity in an abstract sense. Remember, that's exactly what he had castigated Bordiga for being a guy who very vaguely spoke of working-class solidarity where there was no working class. But we have gone a bit far off from, so I apologize for that.
Okay, let's hear somebody else.
May I just end the discussion by asking about another concept? You emphasized historical bloc. You emphasized the idea of misplaced alliance.
More than that.
Another idea which you surfaced, it took from Gramsci, was the idea of the colonized intellectual. Do you think that's an idea? Given the fact that you're moving, as it were, from Gramsci, rather than just, trying to do an exegesis of Gramsci, do you think that the colonized intellectual is an idea which has a strong force, say, in Malta or Sicily or Sardinia? Do you think it helps explain perhaps the intellectual's position in Maltese or Sicilian politics, meridionalis politics today?
Well, I don't know if I can answer that one. the point I made about where he talks about the cosmopolitan intellectual, he makes that in various places, but particularly with regard to language. For example, one of the things is how the Italian language basically was a passive revolution. It was something imposed, so that's why I made that comment there. So for him it was that he has a very, very, I wouldn't really go into that, basically how he talks about the language question and how he saw that coming up across when he talks about he believes in spontaneous grammars as opposed to, I forgot the other term that he used, the one which is imposed. And he has a very, now he becomes romanticized, he romanticizes a lot here when he talks about that we need a national popular language, and how does he come about? How this will come about is basically through some kind of synthesis between the various spontaneous grammars that exist. And I find it very hard to see that happening. And he sees the intellectuals as playing a very important role there. But what he says is basically some of the intellectuals who could have done the work. Okay, now he's using a very narrow notion of intellectual, not the broad notion of intellectual that people have read into Gramsci, and the way he uses the concept of intellectual in a much broader sense is that the traditional intellectuals have not done their work because they themselves speak a language which cuts them off from the rest of the people. Now, to what extent are intellectuals colonized today? One can generalize. It's very easy to say, it's very easy for any kind of educated person today to support the status quo. One looks at what his or her function is in society. People who go against the grain, if you look at Malta, let's be more concrete, I think are few and far between. But they are there. They are there, but they're not the majority. I mean, I don't know how I can answer that question, really. Is the intellectual colonized? I don't know. I really wouldn't be able to answer that. It's an interesting study, actually. Interviewing people and then how you define intellectual. How you define intellectual. A person who creates opinions, a person who is an opinion maker, a person who cements or challenges a particular vision of society. Are intellectuals colonized? I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, the easy answer to give about is to say yes, they are. A very conservative society. Intellectuals react in a particular way, etc. Are intellectuals colonized? I don't know. I'll put this question to the floor.
Well, I think what's interesting about your paper is it really has raised a number of questions and issues, and what comes across in listening to you and Mario Vella. Discussing Gramsci, his applicability or unapplicability, one thing that comes across is that Gramsci himself had a very practical edge to his thought. And if we're going to see how we're to understand Gramsci written already almost 100 years ago in today's world, one has to at least try to retrieve that extremely practical edge to
his thought.
As in Mario's question, Gramsci, in the circumstances of the Brazilian or the Peruvian-Colombian border, would not be trying to come up with an abstract formulation of a social formation. He would rather be asking, what groups can we unite here? If not, why not? And in that respect, in a sense, Gramsci's sociology flows from his hard-nosed practical desire
for worker revolution,
we can say.
Well, that was the situation he was in. He was looking at Italy, not cutting it off from the rest. Basically, he had been writing all sorts of stuff before. Now he had the opportunity to look back. Why has the revolution failed? What role have intellectuals played in this context? Various strands in his work, in his notebooks. But obviously, it is something which is born out of practice. And also, as Eric Hobsbawm would say, he has this chance now to write, although he does use some of the Marxist concepts which were very much in vogue at the time, he was away from the clutches of Stalin in that respect, and he writes in such a way that, there's an analysis taking place. But the basis is Italian society. Now, what I try to do here is to try to go beyond Italian society. I try to look at a particular context with a particular focus, actually the focus on migration, primarily. That's the major part which comes through. And use some of his insights. Now, that doesn't mean that he's the only one who said those things. I try to link those two with other writers, much more contemporary, some of whom have drawn on Gramsci, basically is to reinvent in a particular context. So, of course, every context, back to your question, Mario, every contest throws up its own issues, of course. And I would say that Gramsci can be used, even without mentioning him, in various contexts according to the issues which emerge at a particular point in time. So you can have a particular issue in a particular country, say, revolving around human rights, for example, that can bring people together. The one question I have is, well, I've never really come to terms with here, is that how does one, now here is probably where we have a romanticized notion of a historic bloc, because I've seen this used a lot in terms of the coming together of various social movements at the World Social Forum, where you have movements which were, you know, so particularistic before, but coming together, converging. There, I think there's a danger of romanticization, because they use those terms at the World Social Forum in that regard. Basically, what I try to do here is to sum up, is I was using the Southern question, obviously intrigued by what Gramsci wrote about the Southern question, because it always fascinated me, and his notes, particularly those on Italian history, and to see how I can use some of those concepts, but they have to be changed, because the context has changed in terms of the current scenario right now. My particular focus I hate to use the word multicultural, but a much more multi-ethnic society emerging with all the issues that it raises, the bifurcation it brings about amongst subaltern groups, and what challenges can emerge from this for a socialist project. That's basically what I try to do. And I still believe, and I honestly believe that the whole issue of race is central. It's never on its own. It's connected with class, it's connected with gender, it's connected with many things. It's central to a socialist project. I don't think that Gramsci's issue of misplaced alliances is something to be rejected. It is forceful in his writings. It comes through. I did not romanticize the peasant proletariat. That is his historical past. I am looking about false alliances in this particular context in the Mediterranean, because this is not just Malta, where, for example, even political parties which are, you know, political parties which once had a sense of worker solidarity, even if that sounds rhetorical, are not doing basically the work which is necessary. And I think the Labour Party in Malta is a classic example of this. It's terrible in this respect, I would say. It's not doing the work which is necessary, because it only looks in terms of 5 years. It looks in terms of going to the vote. It is not prepared to do the long work which is required for some tiny aspects of a larger concept known as the intellectual and moral reform that Gramsci was so much concerned with. I'm saying a tiny aspect, because the intellectual moral reform, he uses Protestantism as an example, something much bigger. And I think we have a lot to learn, not just from Gramsci, from other writers in this respect. And I wonder, you know, when organizations which once had a socialist background and now don't want to use that word anymore, are going to derive insights from people like Gramsci and others for the specific context, not apply, we don't apply, you reinvent to do this work. This is a lengthy period. It's a lengthy work. It's not a work for 5 years. It's a work based on consciousness raising and consciousness building. And I think that's where the whole issue of the misplaced alliances comes in. Capitalism has proved to be very dynamic. It still is. It will always be dynamic. And one of the things is its ability to create false alliances. Managers and workers against the competition. How a jobs crisis is presented as a skills crisis, you know, great training robberies and all that. So in this case, I use the issue of race, because I think it's fundamental right now in terms of what's happening in the Mediterranean. It's something, of course, which comes from the heart. It's something which gals me. So it's not something I'm doing an exegesis, as somebody said. It's not that. It's something which hits me. I'm using this. I was always fascinated by that particular piece. It's not it's not like you're going to apply it cargo style today, because it is not. It's a different context. I thought that was ABC. That was very, 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 very clear what I was saying. You know, I almost take that as an insult, actually, not to have, to be the slightest suggestion that I did not see that. But basically, I picked up, amongst many other teams, the issue of misplaced alliances. It is very strong in Alcuni Temi sulla Questione Meridionale. Read it, and you can judge for yourselves the whole issue. He's looking about Sardinians, the whole idea, what does it mean to be a Sardinian in terms of when there are divisions of class. And I think this can be a way of reinventing one of these insights for Gramsci, but not just Gramsci. There are other people who have been writing about this. More recently, people like Cornel West, Du Bois in America has written about this stuff. And I do I make a lot of references to other people's work in this respect. What does it mean today in terms of a socialist project? Sorry, but
thank you very much.
I couldn't resist that. Right.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Gramsci, the Southern Question and the Mediterranean. This talk was delivered by Professor Peter Mayo.